Good morning, and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Marisa DeMarco, a reporter here at KUNM. Congress is considering more work requirements for people who use the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. We heard from folks on our show 2 weeks ago that that might be especially hard for people in rural areas where jobs can be hard to find. This week, we're picking up on that conversation, and we'll also be talking about the challenges that eligible immigrants and mixed status families face when it comes to accessing food assistance. What do you think of adding more work requirements to SNAP? Or have you ever faced accepting a small raise or a new job and possibly losing your benefits? How did you calculate the risk and what did you do? What should the government's role be in dealing with hunger, healthcare, and access to food? We're talking about food assistance programs today. Join the conversation by calling 277-5866. You can tweet us, too, with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Paola Marichaux is a clinical social worker at the UNMH Young Children's Health Center. Good morning, Paola.
Good morning.
One of the things we're talking about here today is barriers for mixed status families. So that's a household where maybe some members are citizens or have an immigration status that makes them eligible for food or medical assistance, and other members of the family don't. So you work with folks in the International District in Albuquerque. What are some of the problems that you see in your work, Paola?
Yeah, that's correct. I've been working there, providing home visits for the last 17 years. And over those years, the most difficult issue is the systemic issue related to applying for a SNAP. Barriers that we find from families that we serve that come to the clinic, the pediatric clinic, is the language barrier. Not only the language barrier, but also how to communicate and be heard when they are in the office space where they apply for SNAP. Another issue that I see coming, and it has been an issue previously, of course, is most families work. They do work and receive minimum wage. And as their minimum wage from $8.45 or $8.50 increased to $9 an hour, their SNAP benefits decrease substantially and not in the same rate as their, you know, 50 cents increase of pay. Finally, the most difficult thing, too, is that they may take one day, 2 days even, from work and not be paid to be applying for food for the SNAP assistance. And that causes tremendous stress, not just because they are thinking of the food, but the tremendous stress meant, you know, the well-being of the family. It affects their well-being.
Yeah, and when we're talking about language barriers, we're talking about all kinds of languages in the International District, especially because you're talking about refugee families, folks from all over the world, right?
Correct, yes. And sometimes the families are fortunate, and the providers over at the Income Support Division office who provide the service will provide them with access to interpretation over the phone. Sometimes, for whatever reason, it's not possible to do so, and it's extremely difficult for them to be able to communicate with them. And that I hear from when we are not there present with them, because if we do go with them, and we generally go with them, we first say, go to the office. You're eligible, and you can apply, and they should, by law, provide you with your language for communication. Mm-hmm. But if you don't get any response positive to you, please call us, and we'll go with you. So often we end up having to go with them, and then we provide our Pacific Line interpreter services that we have over the phone and provide the service with them. And interestingly enough, the time in the office reduces at least two or three folds for the family when we are present mm-hmm. with them. And I attribute that to the fact that we are, again, goes back to that communication style, not because we speak the English language, but because we understand what the eligibility criteria is and we are informed of what it is that they are eligible.
Yeah, and is it intimidating to for folks to like go into these kind of bureaucratic processes or these government offices? Is there an intimidation factor there too?
Yes, it is. And also the fact that someone is going to a place to ask for assistance for food is in itself something that most people are not comfortable with. Everyone wants to work. Everyone does most majority work. And food is a basic need. It's something that it's a celebrated in most cultures. Food is life. Food is a celebration. And to have to be going through some difficult and at times humiliating situations, myself included, have had that difficulty 30 years ago when my children were very young, and now they are in college and already graduated. So, but 30 years ago, I went through that, and I end up not going back because it was a very humiliating situation. I feel for the families, and I think it's not just about asking for food, but also how you're treated. I am not here to blame anyone that's servicing families. On the contrary, I think the people who serve the families are just overworked. The whole system and administration of the place itself is in great chaos from my perspective when I am there. There's always someone else. There's a huge turnover, and it's a triggering effect. People don't seem to be treated as with the same respect they would need to have, and that triggers to the families that whole frustration.
Yeah, and for 30 years, there's been this lawsuit in the state of New Mexico about how, you know, how that system is operating. And, you know, the union of workers who work at ISD all say that there's not enough people staffed in these offices. The caseloads are immense. And one of the problems that's come up in the lawsuit is making sure that people who are eligible for SNAP get it. And the court just ordered the state to hire an expert on immigration and benefits. So that expert might be hired in early June. Do you think that'll help, Paula, if there's an expert at the state who's really keeping everybody informed about what the complicated rules are for people who've immigrated here?
I think that, excuse me, I think that's a very nice step in the right direction. I think it's not the solution, and definitely it's great. I think we need to see a multidisciplinary approach to the work in the income support division, and I say that in the sense where there are multiple disciplines in the workspace that not just understand cultures, but also understand communication among people, especially people who work within the office space. I don't know the culture of ISD, but I know every workspace needs to be always nurtured and worked on to enhance their communication so that they can service the public with some kindness and some respect that they deserve. And then just to answer your question, I think it's great that they are making that, they want to do that.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, and what are, so we're talking about kind of this bigger, like, systemic issue, but your work also focuses on children. So what are, what's the result of people not being able to access food and nutrition for their, for themselves or for their kids?
Well, being that we're a pediatric clinic and we have medical providers and we do look at growth charts to children that we provide services to, food nutrition is a very, very important thing. We also understand that it's important for us to provide information about the foods that are the good foods for the families. I'll give you an example. I was at a home visit the other day, and this one single parent of a six-year-old and a four-year-old, actually the little one is two-year-old, she had no food in the refrigerator. She had a soda, orange soda, and some fish, dried fish, because that's something that can keep for weeks. And that was the food. And when I asked her if she had food stamps, she said she had no time to go to get food stamps because she does work from 7:30 to 5 o'clock Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. And she also said, excuse me. And so when I thought about the soda issue, it is indeed something that it fills the tummy for her children. It's what they like to drink. So this is being a supplement to the nutritional food that they would have. So that is unacceptable. I think, yes, we have food box for families in different churches, different places. But a lot of the families, again, don't eat the foods that are in the food boxes, and because of how they were brought up and how they cook. So,
So culturally appropriate food.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Carolyn Muraida is a community health worker at Casa de Salud in the South Valley of Albuquerque. Good morning, Caroline.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. What do you think about what Paola is talking about here? Does all of this stuff kind of sound familiar to you?
Paola gave an excellent and thorough description of a lot of the barriers that I see in my work as well. So some of it might be summarizing, but definitely. So Casa de Salud is a clinic in the South Valley of Albuquerque. It's a community health center with a variety of Western and Oriental clinicians and services. As a community health worker there, we see primarily Spanish-speaking only patients seeking primary care, and families are included in that. So a lot of the barriers that we see materially at first are often transportation, getting to and from a place that can address their social services needs, including healthcare. The financial burden Paola mentioned of taking off time from work to be able to access public benefits or even healthcare out of pocket. And then once you do arrive to a clinic or to an office, Paola again mentioned that language is a barrier. So mm-hmm. again, I work with primarily Spanish-only speaking patients and clients. And so working to demystify some of the eligibility requirements for individual public benefits is a task in and of itself in English. And then having somebody who's fluent in Spanish or who's proficient in another language other than Spanish be there to also navigate the system is incredibly important. That said, the conversation about compensating staff who demonstrate those competencies at a rate that values their expertise and their value added, That's a systemic issue that I think mm-hmm. needs to be talked about a little bit more. But again, the work of a community health worker addresses a lot of those downstream needs as far as accompaniment or being present, being an advocate, but walking alongside the patient or the client to not only witness those barriers, but also try to mitigate them and make sure that what's being that a client who's eligible for certain services is able to actually receive them.
Yeah, and so what do you see happening generally as people from mixed status families try to access assistance?
there's a lot of confusion about eligibility still, and which isn't to say that there aren't people who are experts in the community as far as enrolling folks or helping folks to apply for public benefits, but for mixed status families, those who do have permanent residence or do have documentation status, who might be eligible for certain programs, fear that any application that they put forth for a federal benefit or even a state-funded one might incriminate or endanger a family member without legal status, mm-hmm. or documented status. So I think really trying to unpack and educate ourselves as a community about what's required to keep a family whole and healthy, and what is a perceived risk and what's actually not dangerous.
Right. We're talking about access to food assistance, also called SNAP today. What do you think about possible federal cuts to the program? What are some of the false ideas or stigmas surrounding food assistance in our culture? Have you ever used SNAP? What would you like people to understand about that experience? Give us a call at 277-5866. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Support comes from the New Mexico Heart Institute, a Southwest cardiology practice with over 40 providers in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. Health plans that include the New Mexico Heart Institute can be found at nmhi.com.
Melisande is madly in love, but not with the man she married. She adores his brother. It's a love triangle that can't end well and doesn't end well, but the story is irresistible for composers. We'll hear Gabriel Fauré's take on the story, his suite from Pelléas and Melisande, on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Marisa DeMarco, and today we're talking about access to SNAP, which used to be known as food stamps. Are you a member of a family with mixed immigration status that could use food assistance benefits? What are some of the barriers to seeking that help? Call us at 277-5866, or if you'd rather we didn't use your name, shoot us an email at letstalk@kunm.org, and we could read your comment on the air. Carolyn Muraida is community health worker at Casa de Salud in the South Valley of Albuquerque. We were talking about some of the barriers that people face, and part of that is fear, you were saying. Fear that engaging with the system could endanger other folks in their family, right? Mm-hmm. And we did just see that Department of Homeland Security was considering penalizing people seeking citizenship who had used government services that they're legally allowed to use, right? So does it feel nerve-wracking to you, Caroline, to encourage people to access benefits and interact with the system when the federal government is going after undocumented people more and more?
It's a delicate situation, certainly, but one that isn't necessarily helped by an additional fear on the part of the community health worker. I think penalizing people for accessing public benefits is wrong. It's just plain and simple wrong. It's dangerous and it's unhealthy for not only the individuals in question, but also for the community. Public benefits aren't necessarily accessed throughout one's entire life. They're often just needed in a moment of crisis, which each of us will experience or have experienced at some point in our life. And I'm grateful that Paola mentioned the need for those in social services at that moment of crisis to demonstrate empathy and to be really clear about cultural humility in those one-on-one interactions. So when it comes to healthcare in particular and nutrition in mixed status families, the healthcare of children in those instances will have long-term effects on the family as a whole, but mm-hmm. also on the community as well.
Yeah, I just want to be super clear that Homeland Security was considering that, but that's not a policy that is in place yet. I don't want to add to any fear-mongering that may be happening.
Definitely.
So that's not happening, but it is something the federal government was thinking about. And also, what happens when people can't get help before they're in, like, a really emergency situation or in a really dire situation? How do you see that in your work?
Well, preventative care is increasingly shown to improve the overall well-being of not just an individual but the family. And I think oftentimes hospitals or clinics think about preventative care as not only a benefit to one's health status, but also to the financial health of the clinic or to the hospital. So that's another argument for really addressing concerns before they become huge issues.
Yeah, and so we've heard from callers. We did this show, a similar show 2 weeks ago. We heard from a caller who was concerned about undocumented immigrants who are taking from the system and using public benefits. But that's really kind of a myth, right?
Definitely. There's a need to, again, demystify a lot of the role of undocumented immigrants in contributing to society and to really focus the conversation on what is being given on behalf of those undocumented members of the community versus what's actually being taken.
Yeah, so I looked it up. According to the USDA, people who aren't citizens but who do have other kinds of documentation or status make up something like 3% of the folks using SNAP here in New Mexico, and 8% of the kids in the state on SNAP live in a household with someone who isn't a citizen. So those are really, small single-digit numbers. When you are thinking about this issue, what are the arguments that can be made? And so there's all these moral arguments, right, about people deserve food, people deserve to not be traumatized, and people deserve health care. Well, what are some of these bigger, like, economic or financial arguments in our society beyond even those moral arguments?
Well, I can focus that answer around healthcare, but I'd be curious to see what the other panelists have to say as well. Increasingly, literature from the medical community is coming out saying that immigrant status is a social determinant of health. And social determinants of health, again, in mixed status families, often include an analysis of the children in those families. And adverse childhood experiences are shown to have repercussions throughout one's entire life. So we talk about traumatic experiences from childhood often in a facetious way in adulthood. But those experiences can translate later on in life into high hypertension or high blood pressure, or which could lead to heart disease, or in families that have predisposed risk to particular types of cancer. These added stresses accumulate over time. And not only does the individual bear the health burden of that later on in life, but so does society. And as a community, we're not able to be our most vibrant selves if we're struggling to breathe or we're struggling to walk, or even go to work. So those financial repercussions will show, as often economists will use maternity rates as indicators for the health of a community or of a state or county.
Listeners, what do you think of what Caroline is saying here, that the government ends up spending more money down the line when people don't have access to the help that they need? Give us a call. Let us know, 277-5866. We've been talking about problems that some mixed status families face here in New Mexico in getting access to food assistance, even when they're legally allowed to use those programs. Patty Keene is a registered dietitian and associate scientist at the UNM Prevention Research Center. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning.
We're talking about access to food. As a nutritionist, what do you see for kids in the short term and in the long term?
So certainly we know that, and the evidence is very clear on what the academic and health impacts are for kids who are experiencing food insecurity. And we know participation in SNAP certainly is highly protective against food insecurity, but we know that still 54% of SNAP participants still experience food insecurity. So SNAP is not the only, it's not the save-all for that. And I think that's important for folks to keep in mind. So we know that we see academic impacts. Children have who are experiencing food insecurity have a harder time getting along with their peers. They tend to skip more classes. There's higher rates of absenteeism. They're more tardy than their food secure classmates. And they also experience higher rates of depression as reported by their parents. And then in terms of physical health impacts, we see in infants, we see higher rates of iron deficiency anemia. We see lower birth weight when the mother is experiencing food insecurity in pregnancy. So certainly there are extensive health implications for kids who are experiencing food insecurity. And as already has been mentioned, that happened in the immediate, and then we see those track into adulthood, what those mm-hmm. challenges are.
So legislation known as the Farm Bill comes around every 5 years or so, and it's about agriculture, but it also deals heavily with federal food programs like SNAP. This year, Congress is considering adding even more work requirements to the program, which could affect millions of people around the country. Listeners, do you already have a job and continue to need food assistance? What do you think needs to change? Give us a call, 277-5866. Patty, this conversation about work requirements is pretty common in the U.S., actually, and I feel like we have it all the time, maybe every time the Farm Bill is coming around. Is there something about this time that makes it different in your mind?
Different. You're absolutely right. It persists. They're looking to implement these for Medicaid, where there already are work requirements in SNAP, which sometimes gets lost in the conversation, too. This is really about increasing those work requirements. And from the perspective of a registered dietitian, we adhere to a code of ethics in our profession, and there's lots to that. But the real solid tenet of that is that we have to consider the health, safety, and welfare of the public at all times in our profession. So when we get into these ideas of work requirements, which we know in practice will kick people off the program. Mm-hmm. And so for us, we know that's going to increase food insecurity. It's going to limit their ability to access a healthy diet. So just first and foremost, as part of our code of ethics, we would have to reject as a profession any initiative that would kick people who otherwise need food assistance off of the program. So forgetting about even the political nature of that, but recognizing that the health impacts would be so huge. And the other thing, and that's been touched on a little bit too, in terms of the health implications. So when we look at, for example, when we take diabetes as an example, because folks who are experiencing food insecurity are at much higher risk for chronic disease, hypertension, diabetes, et cetera. And so we know typically, and for those who aren't familiar, so the SNAP allotment, folks get their allotment at the beginning of the month. And what we see is huge ranges in dietary intake across that month. So we see there's more abundance in the beginning of the month, and then at the end of the month, there's food inadequacy. So we see a 27 for low-income admissions, low-income persons being admitted to the hospital mm-hmm. for low blood sugar. It increases 27% for those who are of low income and remains flat for those who are of regular income. So recognizing, too, that is a huge burden on the healthcare system. So if we look at what that cost might look like, so for an admission, it's about $17,000 for low blood sugar. For an emergency visit, it's almost $1,400. To provide food for a family of four with a SNAP benefit, it's $657 a month. Mm-hmm. So that's what a typical SNAP benefit would look like for a family of four for a month. So certainly it saves us money in the long run, because diabetes costs New Mexico roughly $2 billion a year. just in the cost of diabetes, and the other and medical expenses for those who are who have diabetes and are food insecure are 2.3 times higher than those who are without diabetes. And of that $2 billion a year that I mentioned that are the costs in New Mexico, so $1.6 billion of that is in direct medical expenses, but the rest, so that $424 million are indirect costs mm-hmm. that are related to lost productivity. So people can't go to work and things just sort of can't really move forward. We also know that those who are food insecure and have diabetes have 5 more medical doctor visits per year than those who are food secure. So this is costing us money.
Yeah.
And so understanding what those health impacts are. And also what's already been mentioned is what this sort of psychological distress that happens with families. You know, mental health is a big issue for us here in the state. And if people are further stressed, there's so many stressors that people are trying to deal with and adverse childhood experiences. And if on top of that, we're adding this question of whether or not we're going to have food, period, much less, you know, the ability to access a healthy diet, should be really of concern for all of us. The other thing that I wanted to mention too, and it's so frustrating for me to hear about all of these stories where people cannot access food, because we just need to understand as a state and as a community that this isn't, you know, there's so many arguments. The moral arguments should be enough. Right. It sort of stinks that we have to really make this economic argument, too, you know, but the moral and the health arguments really should be enough for us to come out to be able to fight for these programs.
All right. So we have just real quick. Hold that thought. Zach Ducheneau is the secretary of the board of directors for the Intertribal Agriculture Council. He's a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, and he lives and works on the reservation. Good morning, Zach. Can you hear me?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Yes.
So you're heading to Washington, D.C. today. What are you doing out there?
We are actually in Washington, D.C. right now as part of the Native Farm Bill Coalition, an initiative to increase the awareness on a national scale of the opportunities for economic development through agriculture.
And so what do you think about some of these additional work requirements? What would that mean for people who are living on tribal lands?
So one of the initiatives that we're really advocating for is more tribal control of these programs that are feeding our people. Because, for instance, the state that my reservation lies in, there's a 2-3% unemployment rate. On my reservation, there's an 80% unemployment rate. And we need to make sure that the tribes have effective control of not only the nutrition provision, but also the administration of the work training that's being contemplated in the House version of the Farm Bill. Without that control, we're going to be left to the initiative of the state government, which sometimes isn't the best of relationships in Indian Country.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about redefining healthy food so that it's not just about nutrition, but also about how it's sourced. What do you think makes food healthy?
So from our perspective, if we're providing a healthy food from our property and it's taken from our resources at an exploitive value and it gets over to the I-5 corridor and it's good, healthy, nutritious food, and the people that are buying it are reaping the nutritious benefits of it, we don't feel like that qualifies as healthy food. We feel like all you're doing is displacing the malnourishment into these impoverished communities. So we feel that a critical component to addressing that is adding value to our food products in Indian Country, in our communities, so that we're selling food for the highest tangible price that we can achieve on that, then it will be healthy to the local economy.
What's the big picture here? Are you hoping that tribes can create their own food systems and sustain them?
Well, so the big picture is the folks that lived on this continent 5 centuries ago lived the Farm Bill. It wasn't something that we thought of every 5 years. It was something that we thought of every day. our youth, when they were coming of age, had the equivalent of a PhD in genetics and agronomy, because this was their way of life every day. And what we're trying to do is remind tribal nations that until we take care of this job of feeding ourselves first, we're never going to address all of the other societal ills. It's how we used to live. It's what our culture is. Agriculture is the tradition, and it doesn't matter what the food product is that you're growing. It matters that you're growing it.
All right. Well, thank you for taking a few minutes to speak with us today, Zach Ducheneau. I know you're having a busy day up in Washington, D.C., so thanks for being on the show.
Yes. If I could just add one more point real quickly.
Yeah.
I think it's important to zoom out and look at this as an economic driver for the entire nation. And if we're working to try to move all of these people off of the nutrition rolls, that's a lot of American-grown food that isn't going to be consumed here. And we often lose sight of the linkage between an agriculture economy and the nutrition programs, and we just got to make sure that we remind our policymakers that, hey, that is American-grown, American-processed food that our people are eating in these nutrition programs. Thank you so much for the time, and I welcome any opportunity to continue the discussion further.
Thank you very much, sir. We're talking about the Farm Bill and access to food assistance programs in New Mexico today. How could shifting federal policy affect people here? Does the government save money when it cuts into food programs like SNAP? Give us a call at 277-5866. We're going to take a quick break.
It isn't every day we get a new or newer vehicle. Some of us hang on until they've got 200, maybe 300,000 miles on them. Nothing wrong with that. But when it's time to get the next one, how great to send it off to continue to serve. Not just you and your family, but the entire community by funding KUNM. Give us a call and we'll send a tow truck, handle the sale, and then send you a tax receipt and a KUNM membership. Keep doing good. Call 888-KUNM-CAR.
Some martial arts practitioners are bringing their own native elements into various disciplines for physical and mental health. For some, the martial arts offer a path to healing. For others, it's a way to challenge themselves in competition. Join us for the Native Perspective on Martial Arts on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Marisa DeMarco. Advocates say people living on tribal lands could be especially hard hit by cuts to SNAP that Congress is considering. Do you think tribes should have more control over how food assistance is delivered in their communities? Could SNAP be part of building agricultural economies? Call us at 277-5866 or tweet us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Patty Keene is here with us this morning. I wanted to mention that it's not only SNAP that's being changed with this version of the Farm Bill. There's also a fresh fruits and vegetable program that started in Zuni Pueblo and is now national. What changes are being proposed, Patty?
So thanks for asking this, because I know SNAP is such a big part of this conversation. And so there's some other things that sort of get lost, but from a nutrition standpoint are certainly important to us. So the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Program is this really unique program that's in very low income schools. So this is not in every school. $2.25 million was allocated to New Mexico from USDA to implement the program in 127 schools across the state. And what this program is, and it was Senator Tom Harkin who started it in 2002, and so the pilot was at the Pueblo of Zuni. And it's specific. It's a specifically targeted program to provide fresh and fresh only, fruits and vegetables to children. And it's not within the school meals program. It's in other, it's in after school snacks and things like that. It's separate from the actual meal service. And the reason for this is because we know that low-income children have limited access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And from a nutrition education standpoint, and I run a SNAP education program, we love love all fruits and vegetables. We don't discriminate against frozen or canned. But we know, too, that really having kids have that opportunity to taste fresh fruits and vegetables is so important for establishing those healthy habits early. So in the current version of the Farm Bill, and this is something that we had to kind of battle back against in the last debates around child nutrition reauthorization, they have wanted to change the program to include canned, pureed, frozen, and dried in addition to fresh. So again, we have nothing against those other types of fruits and vegetables, but we really want to maintain the integrity of this fresh fruits and vegetables program. And so they've essentially just renamed the program in the proposed Farm Bill. And so that's another thing that we're pushing back against in our profession, and our professional association is pushing back against several things within the Farm Bill, but that being one of them too.
And that kind of ties into what Zach was talking about on the phone with us earlier, this sort of agricultural argument that SNAP, and especially if it makes use of regional farmers and ranchers, can be used as a way to kind of boost agricultural economies and bring fresh food to people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And programs like the Fresh Fruits and Vegetable Program also absolutely support local New Mexico growers more so than some of those other types, too.
All right. Scott Miller is the CEO and founder of Circles USA, a national nonprofit that's goal is to fight poverty. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Tell us briefly about what's known as the cliff effect. What's the cliff effect?
Well, it was brought up by your first guest. It's when somebody makes more earned income and they get a disproportionate loss in one of the subsidy programs that they're on.
Yeah, and so that's something that your organization is focused on looking at the cliff effect, right?
Yeah, we have chapters in 20 states, and we asked them all 4 years ago, what's the biggest barrier to reaching our goal, which is helping people to get as close to 200% of the federal poverty guidelines for earn income as they can. And it was a resounding cliff effect. That was the big deal, because there are two problems to it. One is the actual cliff that happens. And two is it's very difficult to know what will happen if you take a raise, more hours, or a new job. There aren't calculators that will tell you, oh, that will result in so much loss in food stamps, housing assistance, or child care assistance, or Medicaid, or TANF, cash assistance. So as those as people do exactly what we want them to do, which is the ideology behind the work requirement, what we find is that people get penalized by having an inability to pay or pay for basic needs and take the job that we hope that they take, or take the more hours, or take the raise.
Yeah, and
it's an issue that has to get fixed.
I think the way Paula put it earlier, too, is that this is not always optional. So, for instance, the minimum wage got raised, and then folks saw a steep decline in their benefits, right? So it's not always just about, do you take a job or whatever? Like, it's something that just happened to your paycheck.
Correct.
Yeah.
What we have is a poverty management system rather than a poverty reduction system. If we had a poverty reduction system, we would incentivize every step that people take to become, you know, quote unquote, economically secure and stable and self-sufficient. But because we have a poverty management system that isn't paid for with the goal of getting people out of poverty, then we have this kind of this lazy administrative structure that doesn't prorate programs as people earn money. And that's the big thing for our work. The big thing is to begin looking at what does it take to create a poverty reduction system that would incentivize agencies to help people get out of poverty.
Carolyn, what do you think of what Scott's saying here about having a poverty reduction system versus a poverty management system?
I think it's a great idea, and I look forward to him discussing it a little bit more. But I do think that there is an implicit sort of acknowledgement that this is that there is a shared responsibility on both parts of the social services, those providing social services and those receiving them, to both be in it together, as far as getting out of that difficult difficult moment, but there isn't really an incentive structure in place for both parties to progress. And there's not really an acknowledgement that it's not necessarily a linear process, that there's often hardships that will resurface from time to time, whether or not we like it or not.
Scott, you know, you work all over the country. Do you see that some states handle these issues better than others?
I think there's pockets of insights that are being learned across the country. But I think these insights don't really come until there's a deep commitment made by leadership to see what it takes to get people out of poverty. One of the things that we did with Circles years ago was to say, we're going to show every community we're in what it takes to get 15 or 20 or 30 families completely out of poverty and show the challenges. As soon as you commit to supporting people over a number of years in that process, everything that doesn't work in the community will come to the surface. But if your goal is not to do that, then these problems just become more randomized and more difficult to understand. But when you put them into the context that a family of three needs to earn about $40,000 to be economically stable in most places in the country, then it brings up economic development issues, it brings up policy issues around safety net programs, and it brings up access. All the things that are difficult for people to get out of poverty come right to the surface for policymakers to be able to look at. But it first takes this commitment to say, yes, let's do the whole work required for people to get to 200% of the federal poverty level.
And what kind of ties, you're thinking so big picture, what kind of ties do we see between hunger, SNAP, and also economic development?
Well, the linkage, first of all, the economic development recovery since 2008 primarily went to well-educated folks. You didn't have many blue-collar recovery jobs at all since 2008. So what we're looking at is a completely different economy now, where you have to have a lot of education, training, in most cases, good jobs. So what to do about everybody else that isn't in that position yet? If the emerging economy is changing as rapidly as we see a change, and it takes more education and more skills and more access to high technology jobs or whatever to get into that 200%, then we need to really figure out that journey and make sure that people have enough food, enough shelter, enough stability to be able to go pursue higher education, you know, better certification, whatever is required to deal with this emerging economy.
Paula, you work directly with people who, you know, often are new to this country and who are trying to figure their way through it. What are some of the things that you see that help them start to succeed as they're here?
Well, I think I go back to that fact that, well, first I wanted to address what the speaker just said.
Sure.
Historically, the welfare system has had this problem with focusing on poverty versus focusing on reduction of poverty. So we are where we are because of the lack of people consulting with people like himself or the people who are here in this table as a group to assist with the ameliorating the situation. But to answer your question, every family that I visit has incredible resiliency. They are very, they are experts on survival of many different trauma, or if not trauma, because, and I'm referring to refugee immigrants that we work with from the continent of Africa and Middle East and Asia. They are the expert on knowing what's best for their family. And if we can learn from them what's working well in the family unit, and again, it takes a multidisciplinary approach to that, because you would use what they are telling you is working for them. And that is in relationship with regards to nutrition as well. So I don't know if I answer your question, but the point is the mind is there with each family, and we just need to listen to them and focus on what's working well. They are getting ahead because they are hard workers. They come from their countries educated. They don't speak the language, but they are very intelligent, and they learn very fast, and they are eager to embrace the values of this country because they know and they come with the perception, and they still think this is a country that's going to protect them, that's going to provide for their children, and they value education as the number one thing for getting ahead, and they put all that in their children.
Scott, what do you think an effective poverty reduction system would look like if we were to just tear down the whole system as it exists right now and rebuild it anew?
Well, I think the first step is to say how many children in the families do we want to help get to 200%, and then we break it down by creating these poverty reduction teams across New Mexico that would say, okay, we'll work with 15 to 20 families for as long as it takes, and then we'll provide data to a central planning system that will take a look at the service gaps and the system barriers, both in getting jobs and being able to keep those jobs and then advance in those jobs. We'll provide that data, and then the planners would work with the funders to redirect resources in a way that things become more systematic. So if you look at five areas of getting self-sufficient, you have crisis intervention, which people will go in and out of. Then you have stabilization efforts like food stamps. Then you have a readiness for the workforce, which can include all sorts of education and training. Then you have placement efforts and advancement. This can take 3 to 5 to 7 years for some families to be able to navigate and really get into a career that provides everything that they're looking for to cover their basic needs and then some.
All right, and Scott, all I'm so sorry. We are totally out of time, but I thank you so much for being on our show today. We are at the end of an hour, at the end of this hour. Thank you for joining us today on Let's Talk New Mexico. Paolo Marichaux, Caroline Muraida from Casa de Salud Clinic, Patty Keene from the UNM Prevention Research Center, Zach Ducheneau of the Intertribal Agricultural Council, and Scott Miller, CEO and founder of Circles USA. Thank you, everyone. If you missed any of our program, or if you'd like to share it with friends, the audio of this show will be posted to our website, KUNM.org, where you can also find previous shows. Thanks to Marino Spencer, our engineer today. Mallory Begay screened your calls. Victor Onimale live tweeted this show. And Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Marisa DeMarco. This is KUNM.